WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Jack B., sitting in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Days after the Enron and WorldCom scandals broke, shareholders spoke poignantly of lost pensions and broken dreams. Now they're fighting back, using the courts to hold companies and CEOs accountable. In this hour, the lawyer who's taking on corporate America one Enron at a time. We begin in Washington, where new trade legislation is being heralded as a major victory for the Bush administration. Today, President Bush signed a bill that allows him to negotiate trade agreements with foreign countries. Congress cannot amend these agreements, only or accept or reject them as negotiated. Richard Dunham is the White House correspondent for Business Week. I spoke with him earlier today and asked what this so-called fast-track legislation entails.
Fast-track is a method to allow the president to negotiate trade treaties, trade pacts with other countries without congressional micromanagement. Instead of Congress being able to amend, to change the bills as they'd like, they have a choice of voting up or down. And so it gives the president a lot more power in negotiating with other countries because members of Congress have to take it all or nothing.
Is there a separation of powers argument somewhere in the back of this that Congress is sort of delegating away one of its powers?
That's a very good point, and the answer is yes. Congress is voluntarily giving up its own powers, so it's not unconstitutional because Congress agreed to do it. But some people in Congress, some constitutionalists, say that it should never have happened, and that's one of the reasons that Bill Clinton lost that power for the past 7 years.
He lost it because Congress just didn't want to give away those powers. It was a Republican Congress.
The Republicans in Congress didn't want to give away those powers to Bill Clinton. And Democrats in Congress, many Democrats in Congress, did not believe in the philosophy of the trade liberalization. They wanted more controls on trade so that they could amend legislation, particularly to protect the environment and to protect labor interests around the world.
The legislation contains at least some gestures toward laid-off workers. What are those?
That was part of the compromise to get it through. There will be additional revenues for workers who have lost their jobs because of trade. There will be additional health care benefits that people will be available for if their loss of job is related at all, directly or indirectly, to trade, and there will be some specific aid for people in agriculture, textiles, even trucking, if trade has contributed to the loss of a job.
Now, of course, it was a 215 to 212 vote in the House, very close.
Right.
It was a bigger vote, bigger margin than that in the Senate. But in these big trade clashes, there are interests on either side. Who were the winners and who were the losers in this legislation?
Well, I'd say the big winners would be the farm interests in the United States, particularly in the Midwest. You would also have to say tech interests and then multinational manufacturers. Those are the big winners in it.
They're the winners because...
Well, number one, there will be more trade. If there are more U.S. products abroad, means more for farmers in the Midwest, whether you're talking about wheat, whether you're talking about cattle or chickens.
Mm-hmm.
And for multinational manufacturers, they will benefit because there will be more global trade, whether they're based in the United States or based abroad. In theory, having additional trade will benefit them, whether it means more workers in the United States or more workers in Asia, Central America, Africa.
And who are the losers?
Biggest losers probably would be people on in organized labor who pushed all out and nearly killed the thing in the House but didn't quite make it, because it's likely there will be a loss of manufacturing jobs in the United States as a result of trade liberalization. You can argue whether it would have happened whether or not there was fast track. Then some specific sectors of the economy in the South, textile industry is a loser. Steel is probably a loser, even though the president has gone out of his way to protect the U.S. steel industry. That in theory, free trade globally would probably hurt the U.S. in steel because other countries do have more supports for their steel industry than we do.
I must say, I'm a little surprised that it got as many as 20 Democratic votes in the Senate, just because the president himself, as you say, has sort of legitimated intervention in trade, managed trade. I guess I don't understand, just call me naive, why is it that we can't put labor rights into these? In other words, say, we'll trade with you, but you've got to allow workers to have the right to organize unions. Why is that such a huge no-no?
Well, I think what happens is, again, it's a combination of Republican president and, for the years before 2001, Republican Congress. When you had a Republican Senate, you were not going to get those kind of labor rights attached to a fast-track bill, particularly with a Republican Senate and a Democratic president. I mean, I would call it the luck of the last election, where if you had a Republican president come in, if you had a President Gore who was a generally free trade Democrat with a Democratic Senate, you might have had a different situation. Mm. But it was a combination of a Republican president who was not going to push for that to be a part of fast-track with the Republican Senate during the Clinton years, that both didn't particularly want to give Bill Clinton the mm-hmm. powers.
Now, these are we're going to open negotiations with all of South America. Is the idea to have a kind of free trade zone from Canada to Tierra del Fuego?
Precisely. I think that will be the second phase. The first phase, we will see specific countries, and I think Singapore and Chile are going to be the first ones that you're going to see, and they'll sort of be test market packages to see how they go. Then the president may push for Australia and Central America as a block, and then Southern Africa. One of the initiatives of the Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill is to increase trade in sub-Saharan Africa, particularly in five Southern African nations. So I think we will see those, and then you'll see, I think it'll be a second Bush term, if Bush would win re-election in 2004, before we see this free trade area of the Americas. But that's the ultimate goal for his administration.
Richard Dunham is the White House correspondent for Business Week. He spoke with me earlier today from Washington. William LaRocque is a scourge of corporate malfeasance. He's going after white-collar crimes most wanted: WorldCom, Enron, Global Crossing. And it's not just about the money. The court system is one of the best ways to hold companies accountable for their sins and to prevent future ones. His approach has been called corporate governance at gunpoint, a description he embraces. Just remember, he says, oftentimes more is obtained with a kind word and a gun than a kind word alone. Do you agree with William LaRocque? Is suing corporate America the best way to get it back on track? Can class action lawsuits bring about corporate reform? Or is holding big business accountable in court too little, too late? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from San Diego is William LaRocque, a securities lawyer with Milberg, Weiss, Burchard, Hines, and LaRocque. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be with you.
Well, we're happy to have you on here. William LaRocque, last week we did a show on the criminal side of the of bringing these companies to justice, and it was pretty discouraging. We heard that the standard of proof required makes it very hard to get to see these people indicted and jailed for fraud, that the standard of, for example, intent to commit fraud, and that the legal standard of proof beyond a reasonable doubt make it very, very difficult to get them on the criminal side. We had a caller, Barbara from Wisconsin, who said, you know, I've been mugged in my life, my house has been broken into, my car has been stolen, but I've never had anything done to me as what one of these companies did to me in defrauding her. What can Barbara and other stockholders who lost their stake, lost their pensions in because of corporate malfeasance or fraud, what can they do on the civil side to get it back?
Well, you're absolutely right. The criminal justice system has a very hard time dealing with corporate crimes. The corporate criminals are represented by the best lawyers in America, paid for by the corporate till. Look how close Arthur Andersen came to getting away with destroying documents. The criminal justice system, very inadequate to deal with this upsurge in financial misconduct. The civil litigation system isn't perfect either, but it's better than the criminal system. The civil justice system gives ordinary individuals an avenue to express their frustration, their anger, and their desire for accountability. An ordinary person can go into our court system and say, hey, look, WorldCom, Enron, whatever you are, you people cheated me. I'm exercising my rights as a citizen. I'm suing you. Now come to court and answer for what you did. It's a very important part of the system.
Mm-hmm. And what is the different standard there? For example, you're representing a case against Enron. What is the case you're going to be making?
Well, the difference that you're alluding to is that in the criminal justice system, you need proof beyond a reasonable doubt, and it means people are going to jail. That is a difficult burden of proof for prosecutors, and it scares jurors. Mm. In a civil litigation, it's a much lower burden of proof, just a preponderance of the evidence, just a little bit more likely that it's true than not. And that gives the person who's willing to go to court in Enron or Dynegy or WorldCom a much more level and fairer playing field to make their allegations and prove them and hold people accountable. And I think jurors are much more willing to say, look, defendant, give up that big, huge, fantastic house we've seen in Florida that you're building, rather than just put them in jail.
Mm. And yet we heard that one of the weaknesses of civil litigation, and this is because of corporate lobbying in Congress, is that the RICO statute, which might apply in a criminal case and under which assets would be frozen, does not apply in the civil system. Is that right?
And what a shame.
Mm. What does that mean? Give us that.
Well, here's what it means. Yeah. I'll tell you. About several years ago when Charles Keating, that financial psychopath with Lincoln Savings and Loan, mm-hmm. helped cheat elderly Americans, 26,000 of them, out of $275 million, we went to court. We sued him and his lawyers and investment bankers under RICO. RICO has a 3x your damages provision. It's punitive. We used that to get all $280 million back for those victims. But you know what happened then? The accounting firms and the law firms went to Congress, and in the 95 Act, they got them to eliminate the ability of ordinary people in this country to use the RICO statute to remedy securities fraud, no matter how horrible the fraud. That was one of the terrible cutbacks on investor protection in 1995 that led to the excesses we see today.
And yet that wasn't even brought up in all this talk about corporate reform.
Never even mentioned. And I don't want to be critical of Senator Sarbanes for the new bill. It has some good things in it. But let me tell you the bottom line. There's not one word in that bill that enables defrauded investors or helps defrauded investors get their money back. And that's just a shame.
Mm. Well, can people – you're making arguments now against particular companies. Is the case for you against Enron a tougher case than, say, WorldCom? What's the – how do you – give us a sense of the arguments?
Well, each case is different and individualized. The WorldCom fraud, as some others have said, is huge and simple.
Mm-hmm. $4 billion.
Yeah, I mean, like my monthly phone bill was an asset, not an expense. That's huge and simple. The Enron fraud is huge and complex. But I'll tell you a common theme in all of these frauds that's very disturbing. The corporate executives always come forward and say, my lawyer said it was all right. Mm. My accountant said it was all right. My investment banker said it was all right. This is a breakdown in the system because all these professionals are insulated from liability. So it's easy for the corporate executive to point to them, and because they're immune or it's very difficult to hold them liable, the professionals sort of sit there and nod their heads yes.
And they do. We're going to come right back with you, William LaRocque. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
From Boston.
I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the civil side of justice here, about class action suits against corporations on behalf of shareholders to see if they can get back their stake or a portion of it. We're talking with William LaRocque, who's sort of the Carrie Nation of lawyers against corporate fraud. And we're inviting your questions. Have you lost money through one of these putative frauds? Would you like to join his lawsuit or another class action lawsuit to get it back? And what chances do you think you have of getting it back? Let's take a call. Mark is calling from Sheboygan, Wisconsin.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question maybe the guest could comment on. I know sometime, I think it was late 1800s, when the Supreme Court bestowed basically the right of personhood on corporations, and they basically have all the rights of a citizen except the right to vote.
Mm.
And I have a feeling that plays into a lot of legal situations to this very day, so I'll take my answers off the air. Thanks.
William LaRocque, the personhood of corporations and the immunity it might give them.
Very nice question and perceptive one. The corporate form of business in America was constructed so that they could accumulate capital, but the investors would not be personally liable. An investor in WorldCom or Enron or any of these companies is not responsible for the wrongdoing of management. But unfortunately, like so many good ideas, it gets magnified over time. Now we find corporate immunity extending to officers, directors, and the like who don't have to answer for their own personal wrongdoing. I think the guest sort of or the questioner makes a pretty good point. One of the real weaknesses in our system is lack of individual accountability. Maybe this is being cured by the few arrests and criminal prosecutions we now see. But I'll tell you something. If corporate executives, investment banking executives, really faced the prospect of going away to jail or giving up their own personal fortunes, there'd be a lot more better behavior in the system. The problem now is they use the corporate assets and insurance policies. They protect themselves from personal accountability. I mean, if I could make the point, what does Ken Lay care if he has to go to jail? And I don't mean to pick on him. For a year or two, if he ends up with 7 of his 14 houses and 30 million of his $60 million fortune, there's not enough personal accountability.
Mm. Arnold Fastow, his CFO, who was really the main perpetrator or principal in setting up some of the most dubious of these partnerships, he's now building a $15 million house in Houston, and there's nothing people who lost money in Enron can do to stop him or to affect that. Is that right?
Yeah, and it's so frustrating. You know, these corporate insiders in Texas, Florida, and a few other states, they cook the books, then they sell off their own corporate stock and get millions of dollars of illegal trading, insider trading proceeds. But you know what they do with it? They then take it and build Taj Mahals, these fantastic palaces, which are exempt from attachment or remedy under the bankruptcy laws. So it just seems that, you know, over the years, and we've had boom corporate years for 20 years now, I guess, in the system, one by one, have crept all kinds of incentives that simply make it better to lie, cheat, and steal and keep the money for the insiders. And it's tilted the playing field to the point where now we're reaping a bitter harvest with a lot of fraud and a lot of damage to ordinary people.
We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking about civil justice against some of these corporate frauds. Realistically, William LaRocque, you're representing cases against WorldCom, Enron, others. I'm a pensioner. I've had my money essentially defrauded or by Enron. How much of it am I realistically going to get back through your suit?
Not as much as you want or as much as I hope. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the litigation system in America, the federal court system, is really tilted toward corporate interests and business interests. It's tough. You know, one of the real frustrations of the kind of work that I do and my partners do, in the biggest and the worst frauds, the Enrons and the WorldComs and Lincoln Savings years ago, they're the hardest situations to do anything really meaningful for the victims. The company is bankrupt. Mm. You can't recover from them. Mm. The officers and directors, their money is either off seas or hidden or one thing and another. It's very, very hard. Having said that, I think the rise of institutional investors who are outraged over the events of the past few years, mm-hmm. coming into these cases is leading to bigger recoveries. It may only be 15 or 20 cents on the dollar. We hope it's more, but I'll tell you this, it's 15 or 20 cents on the dollar that wouldn't be recovered for victims without the civil litigation system. They'd get nothing.
Mm-hmm. Of course, you also use this and make an argument, and Bill Greider in The Nation makes it for you and with you, that not only is this a way of getting justice or some justice for people who've been the immediate victims of corporate fraud, it's a way of actually promoting, that is to say, civil litigation is a way of promoting corporate reform. Tell us about that avenue.
That's an interesting part of civil litigation. Civil litigation has a couple of purposes. One, obviously, as you indicate, try to get the money back for the victims. Mm. Do the best you can. And to the extent you get the money back, that's great. And the victims feel better and at least they get something back. But there's another important purpose to civil litigation. We call it a prophylactic impact. Mm-hmm. Not only on the individuals involved in a given case as defendants, but far more important, other corporate insiders, law firms, accountants, and investment banks. If they see that corporate malefactors are mm-hmm. dragged into court, held accountable, had their misdeed exposed, that will hopefully chill them from engaging in illegal conduct and hopefully over time have a generally beneficial impact of improving corporate behavior. It's incremental, but it's important, and that's a secondary purpose of civil litigation.
Mm-hmm. Adam is on the line. Hello. Welcome.
Hello. I'm wondering what the estimated transfer of wealth has been from workers' pensions and investor savings to fraudulent corporate executives?
Good question, Adam.
It is a very good question. Very good question. The losses to investors from the market crash in the last couple of years amounts to about $7
trillion. $7
trillion. Trillion. At least a trillion. Trillion and a half of that is due to fraud, not just to a generalized market decline, although it's hard to separate. But I think your caller really makes a good point. Let's look at transfer of wealth. Mm. And here I'm going to focus on something pretty narrow but horribly important, the insider selling binge of these corporate executives brought about by excessive use of stock options. Cisco, $605 million. Enron, $1 billion. AOL Time Warner, $1.5 billion.
This is these are stocks sold by executives in the company.
That is correct. Transferring that money from public investors into their pockets. Mm. I think this is really a part of the horrible excesses we've seen in the last few years that's not been sufficiently focused on. I mean, imagine that a corporate executive can participate in a scheme, falsify the earnings, inflate the stock, pocket even for himself $200 or $300 million. Compare that to the lifetime of work, honest work of an ordinary American, and yet this person walks away from this, no criminal prosecution, using the corporate assets to settle the lawsuit. You know, I often say to people, if you want to create a system where crime pays, you know what? You get a lot of crime in that system. And that's the problem with the corporate governance and corporate legal system in this country today.
It pays. Adam, do you want to respond?
No, I think I agree with the point that there's been an enormous shell game perpetrated where there's been this transfer of wealth from working Americans to the very wealthy.
Would legislation eliminate that? I mean, John McCain has proposed, I believe, something like basically executives would have to hold on to their stock in companies for a period of time they worked there. In other words, you wouldn't have this sort of implicit insider trading that's been going on.
Very good idea, Senator McCain. It's one that we have been proposing for years, and it goes two ways. Number one, corporate executives, when they exercise a stock option, mm-hmm. currently they're allowed to exercise the option at 8 o'clock in the morning, sell the stock at 8:01. It's a cashless transaction, pure profit to them, no risk. That's wrong. They ought to bear some risk. They ought to have to hold that stock that they acquire by option for 6 months, 12 months, I don't care what the period is, but a period. Now, let me tell you another thing we ought to do. Corporate directors mm-hmm. ought to be required to own 20,000, 25,000, 30,000 shares of stock in the company, and they ought to be required to hold that stock for the entire time they're a director of the company. That would, A, prevent their insider trading, give them an ongoing interest in the long-term growth of the company. Everybody agrees, whether it was well-intentioned or not, that our focus on short-term profit targets and growth of corporations has created this incredible short-term mentality. It causes executives to cheat to meet short-term goals so they can sell their stock options. That's something that we have to reform to get back to a more of a at least medium-term, if not long-term, emphasis on corporate growth. It'll help diminish the cheating. It'll help job growth. It'll be good for everybody.
And yet, you know, if you sort of do the regress on this, in the end, isn't it these pension funds themselves that have been the flywheel in this? I mean, they have, mm-hmm. they're now trying to say we're going to help reform, but really they were more speculators than investors. Isn't this right?
Well, the best laid plans of mice and men.
Mm.
The pension funds, I go to their conferences all the time. I get to talk to them and with them. You're so perceptive in that point. They, 25 years ago, wanted to change things to more align the interests of managers mm-hmm. with investors. And the stock option programs were the primary vehicle to do that. As my good friend and general counsel of the California Public Employee Fund, Kayla Gillen, says, stock options are a good idea gone bad.
Mm.
Lots of good ideas as they start out when we've lived with them for 15 or 20 years go bad. I think that a lot of institutional investors recognize that they so incentivized corporate executives towards short-term earnings goals that they have encouraged some of these behaviors. But to their credit, they're trying to reform it now and make it better.
Hmm. We're joined now by William Gibson. He's a professor of sociology at Cal State Long Beach, and he's written an article for the Los Angeles Times that sort of argues that this sort of justice from the bottom that Mr. LaRocque and others represent may be the only way available to us to re-legitimate our system. You say, Mr. Gibson, that we're in a legitimation crisis and that only sort of organized groups from below can change it. What is a legitimation crisis?
Well, all elites, whether they're corporate executives dominating corporations, whether they're politicians in Congress, Senate, and the White House, or whether they're university presidents and the people who administer public school systems, or whether they're the leaders of a church, all institutional elites need to be considered legitimate. They need to be considered both moral and competent in order to enable by those below them in the institution, you know, consumers, workers, mm-hmm. citizens, churchgoers.
Stockholders.
Stockholders. They need to consider the elites legitimate for the elites to continue functioning or for the institution to go on. Well, what we're experiencing now is that legitimacy is vanishing in virtually every major sector of society. The corporate crisis we're talking about tonight is the most visible. But if you just broaden your eyes and just try to, like, see what else has been in the news, you can put the pieces together and see the real scope of the legitimation crisis. Business leaders wouldn't have tried this major fraud if they hadn't been extremely successful in manipulating the political system.
Hmm.
There's something like $700 million of donations in the past 10 years to Republicans. Oh, I beg your pardon, 636 is what Democracy 21 says, and $449 million in donations to Democrats. Well, that's a $1 billion payout over the past decade. That empowers people. There's a sense then that the political system was in their control. Also look at just how much their income superseded that of the ordinary worker. I think it's something like 400-to-1 ratio now.
Mm-hmm.
If you have that kind of stratification, then it gives people a sense they can get away with anything. Look at the Catholic Church.
No.
We've had the crisis on
sure.
child molestation.
Sure.
Look at the public school system where our students are graduated who can't read and write. So we have a sense of crisis, of legitimation crises all across the society. And what we're being offered, and I agree with virtually everything Mr. LaRocque has said, these criminal prosecution legislation is unlikely to be successful. What we need is people acting from below, from the middle strata and from the working class strata, and try to regain control of our institutions. I really admire what Mr. LaRocque is doing. I think the broader significance is that if we look at what he's doing in terms of trying to regain control of the business sector, is that it helps us break through our despair and sense of powerlessness and hopelessness about change.
Mm-hmm.
If we can change one sector, maybe we can, you know, come up with some innovative strategies to regain control of other parts of our life.
And in the end, the source of legitimacy is democratic consent, right?
Exactly. And at least in the democratic society, you know, mm-hmm. in other kinds of traditional
right. And societies,
you could necessarily get away without the consent of the government this way, but in a democratic society, ultimately, you have to have some form of assent.
And of course, we see that in the Catholic Church. They're essentially saying, the laity is saying, let us in. Let us decide. Don't keep us out. And something similar with business. We're going to come right back to the legitimation crisis and to corporate fraud and what you can do about it. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're talking about simple justice this hour, how to get it if you've been defrauded by one of these monsters of peculation, the corporations, and what you can do about it to strike back. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Laura is calling from Gays Mills, Wisconsin. Welcome, Laura.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I guess first I just wanted to say that I'm really grateful considering how many lawyers it seems there are that are really working for this whole corporate mess we're talking about. I'm really grateful to hear about a lawyer out there like your guest who's trying to help people recover their lost real income. I guess my question is, I just wonder, considering, in my opinion anyway, the capitalist system in general and the extent to which it's gone in corporate capitalism itself, that whole system, is, to me, the real problem. And I just wonder how much kind of making some people feel better by getting a little money back is going to just delay the issue of trying to deal with what that whole system is and what it does to our society and to our world at this point.
The system of corporate capitalism, big business.
Yes.
Yeah. What's your response to that, William LaRocque?
Sort of an interesting question. What the guest is really saying is if we dull the razor edge of unrest and frustration, are we going to delay the kind of real reform that we ought to ultimately get? I don't know the answer to that. I sort of share the view that we do need really gut-wrenching, fundamental change to realign the power interests between the corporate community and ordinary people in our country. But, you know, this is a really ongoing struggle we have. Capitalism has its faults and has a lot of faults, but, boy, what an engine of growth and prosperity and good living it is. But it goes into these eras of just unbelievable excess like we're seeing now. Mm-hmm. I don't have an easy answer for her. I'm not a political person. I'm out there trying to get Gay's money back for her if she's been cheated, but she makes a very good point. You know, and not to take us on too long a history lesson,
sure.
The great securities investor protection laws in our country were enacted in 1933 and 1934 within a period of a few months of one another when Franklin Roosevelt was swept into office in an enormous landslide following the stock market crash and depression. Do you know if those laws had not been enacted, and those were revolutionary laws, in that very short period of time, the political climate changed pretty quickly and they never would have been enacted. I think it's a great disappointment about the current era is that we haven't been able to do something more dramatic to more substantially realign the interests in favor of ordinary people and investors.
Something along the lines of a New Deal for today. Something
right.
That would essentially mitigate some of these worst features of corporate capitalism.
Yeah, how right you are. What we got is no New Deal. We got some thin gruel and a lot of, as I've said, windbagging about it. But that's the way it is right now. You know, there's no strong overall political consensus for dramatic change. The professor in his recent article in the LA Times makes the point that, you know, the political parties are largely indistinguishable.
Mm-hmm.
Corporate money is so pervasive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we nibbled around the edges. We got some good changes, but nothing like we had in 33 and 34.
William Gibson, is it possible that we're going to see Kevin Phillips in his recent book says that perhaps a populist rebellion is brewing? He points out that that's how realignments in American politics are usually preceded by great eras of scandal like this, and the people basically say, we have had enough. Do you think that's – are we approaching that?
I think we have to act on the basis of faith. It's like how can things get any worse? It's sort of like if we acquiesce and do nothing, then we know what's going to happen. We know there will simply be elite rule. More people will give up, will stop voting, will just withdraw into private life in denial and apathy. And what democratic openings we have will vanish. I don't know what our real odds are, but we have to act on the basis of faith that there are a lot of angry people out there and that we have to win what victories we can and open up a discussion of the public good so that we can tie together the kind of legal victories that Mr. LaRocque is winning for individual investors, that we tie together an individual victory to a discussion of the common good and what kind of major reforms that we want to have.
Mm-hmm.
It's like this is a doable project.
Sure. Sure. Laura, thank you. Patricia is on the line. Welcome.
Yes, hello. I'm 70 years old, And I have a sociology-type question. How come in a financial crisis they riot in the streets in South America, and I don't see our pensioners rioting in Washington, D.C.?
Hmm. William Larocque, are we too patient here? Do we just sort of take it on the chin?
Well, we're a pro-corporate country, and there's a lot of money left in the pension funds despite the $7 trillion in losses that I mentioned. But I think the questioner makes a good point. Why isn't there more overt, demonstrable outrage over what's happened? Sure, there have been editorials and exposés in the press, but you would sort of think you'd see more. But, you know, Americans are very self-reliant. I've represented investors my whole life as a lawyer. And you know something that I encounter time and time again? I'll be talking to someone, a victim, who's lost their money, been cheated. And you know what most frequently they'll say? It was my fault.
Oh, gosh.
And it wasn't.
American.
Not in any way was it.
Yeah.
But that's something about us as Americans. You know, it was my fault. I should have taken care of myself.
I think
it's a shame that people feel that way.
We frame collective problems as individual problems.
Yeah.
And it is one of the sort of standard tropes of American conservatism, I think, really, to frame them that way. I don't say that's a conspiracy. I say that's how they look at the world. Thank you for your call. Frank is calling from Providence, Rhode Island.
Hi. Maybe I missed it, but in the pursuit for the class action civil relief, I'm curious, where exactly is the money going to come from if the corporations are bankrupt and the individuals have their assets sheltered?
Right. I was a little misty on that one, too, William Larocque.
Well, that's one of our great challenges, isn't it? As I said, often in the worst frauds, the company is bankrupt. Where do we get the money to try to compensate the victims? We look to what we call the professional assisters, the lawyers, the accountants, and the investment bankers. Believe me, none of these large-scale, multi-year, pervasive frauds can take place without skilled professional assisters. The lawyers are there to help draft the documents, to make the deals work, and to mislead the SEC. The accountants are there to help cook the books. Most of all, the investment bankers are there to hype the stock through their securities analysts and raise the money from the public. It's these professional assisters, JP Morgan Chase, Citicorp, Deutsche Bank, Arthur Andersen, the other accounting firms, the big law firms. That's where you have to go to remedy these frauds. But to be honest, these professional organizations are often insulated from liability or very difficult to hold responsible. That's my real challenge as a lawyer representing investors today. Can I figure out a way under the law and using the facts of a given case to hold these professional assisters responsible? That's the name of the game.
You can't finger the people in the corporations because the money is otherwise tied up.
I mean, what are we going to do with Bernie Edwards? Take his ostrich farm away from him? I mean, you know, for God's sakes, you know, the man inflicts $85 billion of damage on people. He's got a couple $100 million ostrich farm. Now, that's not what it's all about. We have to go to the big investment banks that made millions, hundreds of millions of dollars of fees in selling worthless WorldCom bonds and stock to the public. But these are powerful, determined institutions represented by the toughest and best lawyers that money can buy. And that's the fight that we endure day in, day out.
Yes, they're so powerful that even at the height of this outrage, they were lobbying and nearly successfully to prevent anything like what's happening in New York from happening again. That is a state attorney general impounding some of their money. They want to say state governments can't do this. And they nearly got it. That was a shock to me. William Larocque, thank you very much for joining us. William Larocque is a securities lawyer with Milberg, Weiss, Burchard, Hines, and Larocque. And thank you, William Gibson, professor of sociology at Cal State Long Beach. Continue the conversation online. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, putting a human face on America's corporate scandals. This is On Point. Osman Guven came to the United States to live the American dream. Several decades later, he found himself the victim of a corporate nightmare. The 57-year-old former WorldCom employee lost all his retirement money when an accounting scandal left the company's stock worthless. Last week, at a press conference called by Democratic senators, Guven put a human face on the corporate scandals that have been all over the news. Here are excerpts of what he had to say.
I worked faithfully for the same company for 31 years. The company began as Timeshare Incorporated in 1971. And through the years, Timeshare was taken over by MCI, then the WorldCom. Throughout my career as a computer system administrator, I worked long hours and was rewarded with good pay, and for many years, a good employer-paid pension plan. That plan was frozen in 1994 after MCI took over. I was cashed out with a lump sum of $112,000, which I faithfully rolled over into my 401k plan. I also contributed percentage of my paycheck directly into the plan for the past 20 years. At first, my 401k plan was diversified. I gradually started shifting more and more of my funds into WorldCom stock. I did this because I received email from Bernie Ebers and the company executives assuring me of the company's tremendous asset and stability. Based on these statements, I assumed there was a great potential to increase my retirement fund and my family's future security. And why wouldn't I trust these statements? I have a strong work ethic, and I have always been a dedicated employee. But while I was loyal to the company, I now find that they were not loyal to me. I watched the value of my 401k fall from $400,000 to around $3,000 today. To make matters worse, I now find myself unemployed at age 57 in Silicon Valley, where I'll be competing with much younger workers for the few jobs that is available. And now, with WorldCom's bankruptcy, I will not get 26 weeks of severance pay company promised me. It is also unclear whether I will get my health benefits. When I moved to this country, I knew that if I worked hard, was loyal, I would get ahead. Now I ask myself, how could this happen to me in a great country like the United States? I never expected to find myself in this situation. I worked all my life, provided for my six children, and now I have nothing. How do I answer my 15-year-old daughter when she asked me, how could this happen? I have no words for her except to say, I have come to Washington to try to help change things for the others. Thank you.
Osman Guven worked for WorldCom and the companies it took over for 31 years. He lives in San Jose, California. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by UR listeners.